Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 119 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. Episode 119 is a continuation of the History Wander that we began several episodes ago, and it's a continuation of the story of the Great Awakening that we began in the last episode, 118. It's part four of our History of the Mafia. The story of the Great Awakening is a story of how the great secret of the Cosa Nostra was eventually recognized by the U.S. government and ultimately by the nation as a whole. In episode 118, we began the process of laying out all the events that make up the Great Awakening and the beginnings of this process, which revolved around the Kefauver Commission hearings. In episodes 119 and 120 coming up, we will complete the picture of the Great Awakening and tell the story of the McClellan Committee, and then the Appalachian Meeting, and finally the story of Joe Valachi and the Valachi hearings. After we are all said and done with episodes 119 and 120, you might conclude that the public finally figured it out, and then forced the government to recognize publicly what had been known for some time privately within the government, that a national crime syndicate did and does exist in this country. Some folks like Robert Kennedy knew it already and used the McClellan Committee to go further than the Kefauver Commission. And still, other key figures in the government at the time, namely J. Edgar Hoover, who was the FBI director, refused to acknowledge the concept of a national crime syndicate. Well, that was before the Appalachian Meeting. Regarding Hoover, the reasons why he did so are complicated, but may very well have been influenced by his own personal secrets. That is, that the Mafia had compromising pictures of him and knowledge of sexually explicit acts that he engaged in, and the Mafia simply used it as blackmail. Hoover was a homosexual and a closet one at that, and it was in an era that strictly forbade it. So perhaps it is true that the Mafia had compromised Hoover, but the story is really more complicated than just that. Regardless, we'll get to Hoover soon enough. And what I mean by more complicated than that is that we also have to acknowledge through what we learned in episode 118 that there was a pretty big heaping of corruption that was embedded in local governments during that era. Corruption that was controlled to a great extent by the Mafia in certain locales. It was powerful, and Hoover knew it. And he rightly assessed that the federal laws and federal crime-fighting tools were rather weak in the 1920s and the 1930s to get after these scoundrels. And with the existence of local political corruption, all that made for high stakes politically in Hoover's world. So his assessment of the Mafia as a crime-fighting foe was surely a calculated one. And let's face it, in those days it was easier to get funds from Congress to fight against a seemingly insidious Marxist and communist threat than to try and get anyone to fight against a domestic foe such as the Mafia that seemed at best nebulous. So for Hoover, when and how to finally take on the Mafia, if indeed he was forced at some point to do it, and history reveals to us that he was certainly forced finally to do just that. Well, the when and the where and the how would take a big political push and national awakening to make that happen. No doubt the federal crime-fighting apparatus, including the laws that were available to law enforcement, were changing by the time the 1950s rolled around. A good example of this is electronic surveillance and its legality of use in criminal prosecutions. That was coming to age. We'll see how it blossomed later after the Appalachian Meeting and under a federal surveillance program known as ELSSR, which is short for electronic surveillance. So my point here is that Hoover used real and practical circumstances to avoid going after the Mafia. But all of it helped to hide the fact that Hoover, the director, simply had no will to go after the Mafia until ultimately he was politically forced to do so. The McClellan hearings are the first part of our journey today. They are essentially the next step which the Senate took some 7 years after the Kefauver hearings to further expose the National Crime Syndicate, and on this occasion, the extent to which major unions in this country namely the Teamsters Union, was so intertwined in a corrupt way with the Mafia. And of course, enter the Kennedy brothers, eager to get after this topic and eager to turn it into political gain. Some people wonder how Bobby and John got on the same committee together. You'll hear that today. Another question that I frequently hear is, was it Robert's first soiree immediately in 1957? And the answer to that is no. The origins of all of this began really in the early 1950s, and you'll hear the details of that too. Just like Kefauver had tried to do in 1950, though, the Kennedys were showing that they were tough on crime and corruption, and some would say it was to be a platform that could help pave the way to the White House. Perhaps, in the case of the Kennedy brothers on this topic, it was more altruistic than that, but certainly there was an element of calculated political gain in the whole thing. And here, right here, they may have laid the seeds of their own destruction. The public humiliation that the brothers delivered to the Mafia chieftains and to Jimmy Hoffa would create an uneasy relationship with these savory characters at the top of the national syndicate in the United States. And that brings me to the next point. I guess it takes a pretty big helping of arrogance to be a Mafia don, especially in that era. But it was just that arrogance that led to the Appalachian meeting that also happened in 1957. And that brought the whole thing to the forefront for the public, and it paved the way for a wave of investigations that ultimately led to Joe Valachi's testimony at the permanent subcommittee established as part of the McClellan Committee's original efforts. Well, I will stop there because that is a lot to cover in these next couple of episodes, which is why we won't be quite finishing all of it in episode 119, which also means that you have to stick around and listen to episode 120 as well. But it's all more than enough fun for a couple more episodes of JFK, The Enduring Secret. Remember, though, while this is important history that is, in and of itself, interesting, it's being presented here because it's essential to understanding that very time and place in society that was the 1960s, that was the moment leading up to the JFK assassination. And it's essential to understand all the ingredients that made for a presidential assassination. As a juror, you have to put it all together, and these episodes are designed to help you do just that. So, without further ado, let's listen to episode 119 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. Let's start with a few facts about the McClellan Committee, a committee that we first introduced in one of the very first episodes of JFK, The Enduring Secret. Its official name was the United States Senate Select Committee on Improper Activities in Labor and Management. It was a select committee created by the United States Senate on January 30th, 1957, and it was dissolved on March 31, 1960. A little background on Senate committees here. A select or special committee of the United States Congress is a congressional committee appointed to perform a special function that is beyond the authority or capacity of a standing committee. A select committee is usually created by a resolution that outlines its duties and powers and the procedures for appointing members. Select and special committees are often investigative in nature rather than legislative in nature, though some select and special committees have the authority to draft and report legislation. A select committee generally expires on completion of its designated duties, though it can be renewed. Several select committees are treated as standing committees by House and Senate rules and are permanent fixtures in both bodies, continuing from one Congress to the next. Current examples include the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence in the House and the Select Committee on Intelligence in the Senate. The McClellan Committee was directed to study the extent of criminal or other improper practices in the field of labor-management relations, or in groups of employees or employers, and to suggest changes in the laws of the United States that would provide protection against such practices or activities. The McClellan Committee conducted 253 active investigations, served 8,000 subpoenas for witnesses and documents, held 270 days of hearings. It took testimony from 1,526 witnesses. Oh, and by the way, 343 of those witnesses invoked the Fifth Amendment during their course of testimony before the committee. Imagine that. Before it was all over, the McClellan Committee compiled almost 150,000 pages of testimony. At the peak of its activity in 1958, 104 persons worked for the committee. It was a pretty big operation. The Select Committee's work led directly to the enactment of the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act, also known as the Landrum-Griffin Act, and it was passed on September 14, 1959. You will recall that the Kefauver Commission occurred in 1950. Well, actually, the McClellan Committee has its origins shortly thereafter, if some of you are wondering about the seven-year gap between Kefauver and McClellan. It really starts in December 1952, and here is how Robert and John Kennedy came to be a part of it. Robert Kennedy was appointed assistant counsel for the Committee on Government Operations by the then chairman of the committee, Senator Joseph McCarthy. Remember that name? Well, Kennedy resigned that role in July 1953, but rejoined the committee staff as chief minority counsel in February 1954. When the Democrats regained the majority in the Senate in January 1955, Kennedy became the committee's chief counsel. Soon thereafter, the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the U.S. Senate Committee on Government Operations, under the leadership of Democratic Senator John L. McClellan, who was now chair of both the committee and the subcommittee, given the Dems' majority position, well, they began holding hearings into labor racketeering. Thus, the origins of the committee and Robert Kennedy's juxtaposition in it. All of this eventually led to his being chief counsel of the McClellan Committee. Much of the permanent subcommittee's work focused on a scandal which emerged in 1956 in the powerful trade union, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. In the mid-1950s, Midwestern Teamster leader Jimmy Hoffa began an effort to unseat Dave Beck, who was the union's international president. In October 1955, mobster Johnny Dio met with Hoffa in New York City, and the two men conspired to create as many as 15 paper locals, that is, fake local unions, which existed only on paper. And that was to boost Hoffa's delegate totals. When the paper locals applied for charters from the international union, Hoffa's political foes were outraged. A major battle broke out within the Teamsters over whether to charter the locals, and the media attention led to investigations by the U.S. Department of Justice and the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. Beck and the other Teamster leaders subsequently challenged the authority of the Permanent Subcommittee to investigate the union by arguing that the Senate's Labor and Public Welfare Committee, which was a separate committee with different Senate membership composition, that the Labor and Public Welfare Committee had jurisdiction over labor racketeering, not government operations. It was a clever move by the union leaders and their lawyers, and McClellan objected to the transfer of his investigation to the Labor Committee because he felt that the labor chairman, who was none other than Senator John F. Kennedy, was too close to union leaders. It would not thoroughly investigate organized labor. To solve its jurisdictional and political problems, the Senate established on June 30, 1957, an entirely new committee, the Select Committee on Improper Activities in Labor and Management, and gave it broad subpoena and investigative powers. The new Select Committee was given a year to complete its work and charged with studying the extent of criminal or other improper practices in the field of labor management relations or in groups of employees or employers. Half the membership was drawn from the Committee on Government Operations and the other half from the Committee on Labor and Public Welfare. McClellan, Irvin, McCarthy, and Munt were drawn from government operations, and Kennedy, McNamara, Ives, and Goldwater from labor. An equal number of Democrats and Republicans sat on the Select Committee. Senator McClellan was named chair of the Select Committee, and Republican Senator Irving Ives of New York vice chair. Democrats and liberals primarily criticized the committee for not having a neutral attitude toward labor. I guess because only three of the committee's eight members looked on organized labor favorably, and only one of them, Senator Patrick McNamara, was strongly pro-labor. Many view the committee's other five members as being strongly pro-management, and that included the Select Committee's Southern Conservative Chair, John L. McClellan. McClellan hired Robert F. Kennedy as the subcommittee's chief counsel and investigator. Kennedy, too, did not have a neutral opinion of labor unions. He had been appalled by stories he had heard about union intimidation on the West Coast. Kennedy undertook the chief counsel's job, determined to root out union malfeasance. Some would argue that he had little knowledge or understanding at the time, or perhaps even concern over management's misbehavior. That may have been true, but it did not detract from the idea that there was illegal activities going on within the labor unions. Critics of the Select Committee criticized Kennedy as its chief counsel and the committee members as viewing corruption in labor management relations as a problem strictly with unions, without any real management culpability. Senator McClellan gave Robert Kennedy extensive control over the scheduling of testimony, areas of investigation, and questioning of witnesses. This suited McClellan, a conservative Democrat and opponent of labor unions. Robert Kennedy would take the brunt of organized labor's outrage, and McClellan would be free to pursue an anti-labor legislative agenda once the hearings began to draw to a close. Republican members of the Select Committee voiced strong disagreement with McClellan's decision to let Kennedy set the direction for the committee and ask most of the questions, but McClellan largely ignored their protests. Some of the interactions that Robert Kennedy had with high-profile witnesses are now famous. They make up the most-watched film clips of the hearings. They were not pretty exchanges, and those interactions, unfortunately, were not necessarily designed to lay out the legal cases, but they got the point across. They were political high drama at its finest. The most famous of these exchanges is, of course, with Jimmy Hoffa, who was head of the Teamsters Union. There is no doubt that the public humiliation heaped upon Hoffa by Kennedy in these hearings may have been one of the early events that led to a decision by Hoffa to get the Kennedys. Some who followed the hearings might say that these exchanges proved that Kennedy was not an expert interrogator and that he should not have engaged in such high-profile confrontations with them. Possibly so, but these detractors may have not given enough weight to the other side of the equation. What it looks and feels like to the public when good guys stand up to bad guys. Or at least that is the narrative that the Kennedys and the committee were attempting to paint for the public. McClellan and Kennedy's goal had been to refer nearly all their investigations to the Justice Department for prosecution, but the department refused to do so because it concluded that nearly all the legal cases were significantly flawed. A frustrated Robert Kennedy publicly complained about the Justice Department's decisions in September 1958. Robert Kennedy made decisions to investigate a wide range of labor unions and corporations, including the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the United Auto Workers, UAW, and many companies as well, including Anheuser-Busch, Sears, and Occidental Life Insurance. The Select Committee also established formal liaisons with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, the Federal Narcotics Bureau, and the Department of Labor. and other federal agencies, as well as state and local offices and the officials involved in law enforcement. It was clear that the full extent of investigative powers was going to be used to understand the extent of corruption within the union management relationship. The Select Committee focused its attention for most of 1957 on the Teamsters Union. Teamsters President Dave Beck fled the country for a month to avoid its subpoenas before returning in March 1957. The Select Committee had a difficult time investigating the Teamsters. Four of the paper locals were dissolved to avoid committee scrutiny. Several Teamsters staffers provided verbal testimony, which differed substantially from their prior written statements. The Select Committee eventually charged six of them with contempt of Congress, and union records were lost or destroyed, and allegedly on purpose. But working with the FBI, the Select Committee electrified the nation when on February 22, 1957, wiretaps were played in public before a national television audience in which Dio and Hoffa discussed the creation of even more paper locals, including the establishment of a paper local to organize New York City's 30,000 taxi cab drivers and use the charter as a means of extorting money from a wide variety of employers. The 1957 hearings opened with a focus on corruption in Portland, Oregon, and featured the testimony of Portland crime boss Jim Elkins. With the support of 70 hours of taped conversations, Elkins described being approached by two Seattle gangsters about working with the Teamsters to take over Portland's vice operations. The colorful testimony brought the committee's investigations national media attention from the outset, as 1.2 million viewers watched on live television. Evidence was unearthed over the next few weeks of a mob-sponsored plot in which the Oregon Teamsters unions would seize control of the state legislature, the state police, and state attorney general's offices through bribery, extortion, and blackmail. It gets even dicier for Jimmy Hoffa at this point. On March 14, 1957, Jimmy Hoffa was arrested for allegedly trying to bribe an aide to the Select Committee. Hoffa denied the charges, and he was later acquitted of them. But the arrest triggered additional investigations and more arrests and indictments over the following weeks. Less than a week later, Beck admitted to receiving an interest-free $300,000 loan from the Teamsters, which he had never repaid. And the Select Committee investigators claimed that loans to Beck and other union officials and their businesses had cost the Teamsters more than $700,000. Beck appeared before the Select Committee for the first time on March 25, 1957, and he notoriously invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination 117 times. Beck was called before the McClellan Committee again in May 1957, and additional interest-free loans and other potentially illegal and unethical financial transactions were exposed. Based on these revelations, Beck was indicted for tax evasion on May 2, 1957. There is no doubt that this type of high-stakes poker carried out at this level within the country and with these types of characters invoked, at the very least, a lightning rod. And that it was. The Beck and Hoffa hearings generated strong criticisms of Robert Kennedy. Many liberal critics said he was a browbeater, a badgerer, insolent, overbearing, intolerant, and even vicious. Hoffa and other witnesses often were able to anger Kennedy to the point where he lost control and would shout and insult them. Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, one of Robert Kennedy's mentors and a close friend, criticized Kennedy for presuming the guilt of anyone who exercised their Fifth Amendment rights. Noted attorney Edward Bennett Williams accused the Select Committee of bringing witnesses into executive session, ascertaining that they would exercise their Fifth Amendment rights, and then forcing them to return in public and refuse to answer questions, merely to generate media attention. That may have been quite true, and may have been quite appropriate. You see, the use of an executive session is to allow the witness an opportunity to answer a question in a controlled, non-public environment. Their failure to do so, at least in my opinion, made them fair game for asking the question again in public so that they could get it on record for the world to see that these witnesses were taking the Fifth Amendment. Regardless, in all of these circumstances, there are always opposing opinions in these things. During much of the summer and fall of 1957, the Select Committee investigated corruption in the Bakery Workers Union, the United Textile Workers, the Amalgamated Meat Cutters Union, and Transport Workers Union. In the late fall, the committee focused its attention on union busting and examined the behavior of companies such as Morton Packing Company, Continental Baking Company, and even the Sears Roebuck Company. While continuing to investigate and hold hearings on other unions and corporations, the McClellan Committee also began to examine the behavior of Jimmy Hoffa and other Teamster officials. Senator McClellan accused Hoffa of attempting to gain control of the nation's economy and set himself up as a sort of private government. The Select Committee also accused Hoffa of instigating the creation of the paper locals and of arranging for a $400,000 loan to the graft-ridden International Longshoremen's Association in a bid to take over that union and gain Teamsters control of the waterfront as well as warehouses. Johnny Dio, who by late summer 1957 was in prison serving time on bribery and conspiracy charges, was paroled by a federal court in order to testify at the Select Committee hearings. But in a two-hour appearance before the Select Committee, Dio invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination 140 times, and he refused to answer any of the committee's questions. But despite the problems encountered in interrogating Dio, the Select Committee developed additional testimony and evidence alleging widespread corruption in the Hoffa-controlled Teamster units, and that was presented in public in August of 1957. The worsening corruption scandal led the AFL-CIO to eject the Teamsters on December 6, 1957. As the Hoffa hearings occurred in August 1957, the Select Committee met in executive session to restructure its organizations and set its agenda for the future. The Select Committee had succeeded in securing the removal of Beck as Teamsters president and seemed on the verge of sending Jimmy Hoffa to jail as well. But the committee had also been strongly criticized for its handling of witnesses and its apparent one-sidedness in exposing union, but perhaps not management, corruption. To guide the Select Committee's investigations in the future, McClellan established a set of 11 areas of investigation for the committee, 9 of which involved labor misdeeds and only one of which involved management misbehavior, preventing workers from organizing unions. To be fair to those that were pro-union in this analysis, we should point this out. The management-oriented area came last on the committee's list of priorities, and there were no staff assigned to investigate the issue. Nevertheless, under the new committee guidelines, the Select Committee's schedule of hearings slowed. In January 1958, Chairman McClellan asked for and received permission from the Senate to extend the deadline for completing the committee's work for another year. For a short time, early in the year, the Select Committee investigated the International Union of Operating Engineers, and they did uncover a small financial scandal at the top of the union. But the main focus of the committee for the first half of the year was the United Auto Workers. Republicans on the Select Committee, notably Barry Goldwater, had for several months in late 1957 accused Robert Kennedy of covering up extensive corruption in the UAW. The Republicans pointed to a lengthy, ongoing, and sometimes violent strike which the UAW was conducting against the Kohler Plumbing Fixtures Company in Wisconsin. Walter Reuther, president of the auto workers, told the Select Committee investigators that the Kohler Company was committing numerous unfair labor practices against the union and that the union's books were in order. Despite any evidence of mismanagement or organized crime infiltration, Kennedy and McClellan went ahead with hearings on the UAW in February 1958. The 5-week series of hearings produced no evidence of corruption. A second set of hearings into the UAW in September 1959 lasted just 6 days, and once more uncovered no evidence of UAW malfeasance. The September 1959 hearings were the last public hearings the committee ever held. As the UAW hearings were winding down, the Select Committee issued its first interim report on March 24, 1958. The report roundly condemned Jimmy Hoffa, but by now, Hoffa was president of the Teamsters. And it also accused the Teamsters of gathering enough power to destroy the national economy. Refocusing its attention back on the Teamsters, the Select Committee held a short set of hearings in August 1958, intended to expose corruption by the Hoffa regime. But a number of witnesses recanted their written testimony, and the hearings led nowhere. Imagine that. Witnesses recanted their testimony against Hoffa. Do you think they might have been afraid? In February 1959, the Select Committee's attention turned to an investigation of organized crime. McClellan had won yet another one-year extension of the Select Committee's existence in January, giving it additional time for more investigations. This new focus was a natural outgrowth of the committee's previous investigations, but it also reflected the committee's frustration at uncovering really no additional scandals in size and scope, like the one which had rocked the Teamsters. Through much of the spring and summer of 1959, the committee held a series of public hearings which brought a number of organized crime figures to the public's attention, including Anthony Corello, Vito Genovese, Anthony Provenzano, Joey Glimco, Sam Giancana, and Carlos Marcello. Although McClellan wanted to further investigate organized crime, the Select Committee had reached the limits of its jurisdiction, and no further investigations were made. By September 1959, it was clear that the Select Committee was not developing additional information to justify continued operation. A second interim report was released in August 1959, once again denouncing the Teamsters and Jimmy Hoffa. Robert Kennedy resigned as the Select Committee's chief counsel on September 11, 1959, and he did so to join Senator John F. Kennedy's presidential campaign as campaign manager. Committee members became more involved in passing legislation to deal with the abuses that were uncovered. Although his committee had already been dissolved by 1960, McClellan began a related three-year investigation in 1963 into the union benefit plans of labor leader George Barash, alleging misuse and diversion of $4 million of benefit funds. By the way, the story of George Barash is a fascinating one and beyond the scope of today's episode. But I will say this, on the moral question that haunts labor unions and other fiduciaries even today, Barash was a fierce advocate of labor and did some very good things in his lifetime, but it's certainly questionable what he did to siphon off $4 million in funds essentially for educational purposes. Altruistic in nature? Perhaps, but almost inevitably dubious in the reality of its execution. After the investigation, there was a reasonable sense that he never engaged in the redirection of this money for direct personal use. But the creation of the organization to which it went created the subsequent lifeline and platform for him personally as the Teamsters exited the AFL-CIO. Simply put, this is another poster child for the ongoing moral question in the world of tax exemption and trustee and fiduciary responsibility of welfare and pensions and member benefits. He may not have committed a crime under the then existing laws, but was it morally right to create a $4 million foundation from which he undoubtedly benefited? Again, under the law of the times. So in the end, all of this did lead to several pieces of new legislation, including McClellan's own bill on October 12, 1965, setting new fiduciary standards for pension plan trustees. Senator Jacob Javits of New York also introduced bills in 1965 and 1967, increasing regulation on welfare and pension funds to limit the control of plan trustees and administrators. Provisions from all three of these bills ultimately evolved into the guidelines enacted in the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, or the legislation you may have commonly already heard of, referred to as ERISA. Well, I didn't think the McClellan hearing discussion would take up all of episode 119, but it did. So you'll have to wait for episode 120 before we get to the Appalachian meeting and the Valachi hearings. Boy, I really am making you wait. But trust me, it's worth it. Hey, I'm hungry again and it's getting late. Again. So join me shortly for episode 120 of JFK, The Enduring Secret, and we'll finally get to the Appalachian meeting and the Valachi hearings.
Did you say that SOB, I'll break his back?
Who?
You.
Say to who?
To anyone.
Forgive your speech. I don't even know who I was talking about, and I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, Mr. Hoffa, all I'm trying to find out, I'll tell you what I'm talking about. I'm trying to find out whose back you were going to break.
Figure of speech.
Thank you for listening to episode 119 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.